as of today, the partial government shutdown is tied for the spot of longest government shutdown in U.S. history. This time, the disagreement is over funding for President Trump's proposed border wall.
But the original record holder was a shutdown in 1995. That was over a balanced budget fight between then-President Bill Clinton and the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich.
It lasted 21 days, and unless things come together before tomorrow, the current fight will take over as the longest shutdown of the American government in history.
Our next guest has written about how shutdowns have morphed into the big political fights that we see today, and he's got a couple ideas for how Congress and the President can avoid them.
Roy Myers is a professor of political science and an affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Roy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
We're in the midst of a shutdown now. It seems like we've been here or close to here a lot lately. It wasn't always this way, right?
No, the most shutdowns have been relatively short, and in fact, most of them occurred in the 1980s. It wasn't until 1995, 96 that shutdowns became as long as they have been recently. In fact, after the 95, 96 shutdown, the memory of the disadvantages of that shutdown was so strong that we didn't have another one until 2013, but unfortunately that was a long one as well. And now we're going to break the record tomorrow.
That's a little complicated, but I understand that some procedural changes in the 70s and 80s set us up to where these shutdowns were more of a possibility. What happened?
Yeah, the big change was in 1980. President Carter's attorney general named Benjamin Civiletti issued a ruling that if there was a funding gap, which means that the agency hasn't received its regular appropriation, and therefore it's lacking permission from Congress to spend money, that it has to shut down its non-essential activities. Before that ruling, when there was a funding gap, agencies just tended to spend a little less or a little slower than they otherwise would have. But after Civiletti's ruling, once there was a funding gap, the agencies actually had to shut down. And in the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, there were, in fact, were 8 shutdowns, although they were all short. They lasted at most 3 days long.
What was the reasoning behind that decision to say, okay, no approval from Congress, we're going to shut it down, at least in part?
Well, in part, it's just a plain reading of the Constitution, which says that agencies are not, the government agencies are not allowed to spend money unless they receive appropriations from Congress. In addition, there were a series of laws passed in the late 19th century that we commonly call now the Anti-Deficiency Act. So somebody who works for the federal government who has the right to spend money will violate the Anti-Deficiency Act if, in fact, an appropriation hasn't been passed. So in some sense, what Civiletti was doing was protecting federal civil servants from being blamed for spending money when they had no constitutional authority to do so. However, his ruling was so tough that it became obvious that shutting down the government would be really counterproductive, particularly when safety and health was involved. So he modified his ruling in 1981 to allow some exceptions, but still the basic idea was that if Congress and the president couldn't agree on an appropriation for an agency, then those operations had to cease.
Now, on a certain level, this is a balance of federal power issue, right? This is the executive branch spending money, but saying, wait, hold on, if Congress doesn't sign off, they're supposed to have the power of the purse strings. We can't spend that money. So at least philosophically, the way our Constitution is designed, that's not inherently a bad thing, is it?
Right. Political scientists, we tend to talk about our checks and balances system as one of separated institutions sharing powers. So Congress must appropriate funds, but the president has to either sign the bill or his veto has to be overridden. So given that President Trump has said he's not going to sign a bill unless he gets $5.7 billion in funding for his so-called wall, and Congress seems unwilling to pass a bill and override a Trump veto, then we're stuck.
Talking to Roy Myers, political scientist at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, about the politics of shutdown, some of the history and evolution of the shutdown. It seems like what has happened since the early 80s now is that every now and then, maybe more and more often, one side or the other picks one issue sets it as a red line and says, hey, we're going to, you've described this as a game of chicken. We're going to play a game of chicken if we don't get what we want here.
Right. And so the big change was in 95 and 96, as you mentioned in your intro. In 1994, Newt Gingrich led the Republicans to a significant electoral victory and took control of the House. And during that campaign, the Republicans pledged that they were going to honor something that they called the Contract with America. And one of the provisions, or several of the provisions in that document, said that the Republicans weren't going to cut government spending and produce a balanced budget. So they came into office with a, in some sense, obligation to honor that pledge. And so they presented President Clinton with some appropriations bills that were very, very tough on spending. In addition, they wanted to cut so-called mandatory spending, such as Medicare, significantly. And President Clinton opposed both of those options. So in 1995, he vetoed a continuing resolution that would have cut spending pretty dramatically. And so there was a short shutdown in mid-November. And then they decided to end that shutdown and negotiate a little further, but neither side gave way. And then the long shutdown started on December 16th and actually went into 1996 and ended on January 5th.
Have we had enough shutdowns to learn about the political consequences? I mean, we can look at one particular one and say, okay, maybe the Republicans came out worse. But do we have a general sense of how political blame is apportioned in a shutdown?
Well, I think most experts believe that we know enough, but apparently the lesson hasn't been completely learned because we're in a big shutdown now. If you look at the 95-96 shutdown, the Republicans took significant blame, in part because they were being opposed by a very wily president, President Clinton, who was very good at communicating with the public, and he convinced the public, at least many members of the public, not all of them, that Republicans were out to cut what President Clinton called MMEE, which stood for Medicare, Medicaid, Education, and Environment, which are programs that many Americans really like. In 2013, Republicans again closed down the government because they wanted to force President Obama to repeal Obamacare. And now that's, of course, only the informal name for the Affordable Care Act, but it is kind of an amazing idea to think that you could try and use the threat of closing down the government to force a president to take away his signal legislative achievement. And of course, that didn't work either. And in that case, Republicans again received blame for the shutdown, although they really weren't hurt that seriously in the next election in 2014, in part because in the sixth year of a two-term presidential election, it's pretty difficult for a president to keep congressional seats. And of course, there had been that mobilization of the Tea Party that started in 2010 that led towards the recruitment of some very strong Republican candidates and a lot of fundraising support for them.
Do you see a viable fix, whether it's congressional procedure, I don't know what, a viable fix to make these shutdowns less likely?
I don't think there's any procedural shift that can force members of Congress and the president to agree. Now, they could agree ahead of time to avoid these kind of situations by creating what we call an automatic continuing resolution, which would mean that if the regular appropriation bill isn't passed by the beginning of the fiscal year, which is October 1st, there would be an automatic temporary appropriation that could allow the agencies to stay open. The problem with that approach is getting agreement on what level that automatic continuing resolution would be. Republicans have proposed that the level be lower than current spending, and Democrats have proposed that it be higher, that is, adding for the effects of projected inflation. So, and again, we're back at the same kind of impasse between the Democrats and Republicans about what policy should be. The one thing that I think will change congressional and presidential behavior is political opposition to the kind of impasse that we see right now. And in part, that's going to occur if one side or the other or both is hurt at the ballot box. And I think, actually, in this particular case, it's quite likely that, yet again, the Republicans are going to suffer much more blame than Democrats will. And that's in part because President Trump willingly accepted blame for causing a shutdown before it actually even occurred. And in part because he has yet to make a very convincing case for his demand of the wall, at least to most people.
We're talking to Roy Myers of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, looking at the past and present of government shutdowns.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the fact that both parties seem to be adopting this as a way to negotiate? Do you remember the big shutdowns of the 1980s and 90s? What do you remember thinking at the time, and how has your reaction to government shutdowns changed since then? What are some ways to prevent these shutdowns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We continue our conversation about government shutdowns and how they've changed over the years. Roy Myers is with us from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about government shutdowns, why they happen, how they work? Do you have thoughts on government shutdowns now or the ones of the 80s and 90s? And have you so far been impacted in some way? Are you a federal employee who is not getting paid today, have that pay stub that reads zero? Have you gone to a national park over the last couple of weeks? Are you looking for statistics or weather information that isn't out there now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Steve starts us off in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two comments / questions. You know, I'm 48 years old, and with all the shutdowns, the Republicans always get blamed. The media will always blame the Republicans. I've never heard of a situation where the media as a whole blame the Democrats. Secondly, you know, as an argument for the wall, I think Trump should do what Obama did in the gun control, that if it saves just one life, then we have an obligation to do it. And if that's enough for Obama for a gun control, that should be enough for Trump and the wall.
Steve, thanks for the call. First of all, Roy, do you think Republicans have been unfairly blamed for shutdowns, past or present, by the media?
No, not really, although I would agree with the caller to the extent that Democrats are not blameless in this. In fact, if you go back to early last year, Senator Schumer, in fact, led his Democrats into a short-term shutdown because they were insisting that protection for Dreamers be added to an appropriations bill, and of course the administration didn't agree with that. But the difference is the Democrats came to their senses a little faster than Republicans seem to be doing now, and that they insisted that that shutdown continue, but only for a couple days.
And when it comes to the issue of President Obama on gun control and taking executive actions, President Obama did take actions, but they were limited to things that affected certain particular federal policies. They weren't spending bills that Congress would have had to sign off on.
Yeah, so if you're referring to the threat that President Trump has made recently that he might use the National Emergencies Act to, in effect, ignore Article 1 of the Constitution and the congressional power of the purse, that would be an extreme step, although I think President Trump this afternoon signaled that he would be unlikely to do that. I would like to comment about what the caller said regarding the wall, if it would save one life, that it's worth doing. You know, I think it's absolutely correct that border security is a very important policy issue. And the problem here is that right now we're not having a very good conversation either across the country as a whole or between the Congress and the president about how to cost effectively do that. During the earlier discussion of the spending bill for the Department of Homeland Security, actually there was a better discussion. In fact, if you look at the House and Senate appropriation bills, that have been drafted, in particular by Republicans, there's a significant investment in border security. And in fact, many Republicans in Congress have been unwilling to finance the wall because they think it's not cost effective compared to, for example, investments in remote sensing technology. So really, in this particular case, it's President Trump insisting on one particular campaign pledge and not really doing the kind of presidential leadership which depends on persuasion to get his way with Congress.
Steve, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Gary in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon, guys. Say, I hear that 800,000 employees are furloughed and not being paid. And I also have read that the average cost for a government employee all in is $60 an hour. You calculate that out, it's $384 million a day we're wasting. And these people are going to get paid in the end. And the amount of time we shut off, they've been shut down, we could have paid for the wall. You couple that with the fact that Pelosi, Clinton, Trump, and Schumer have all said we need to spend money on a wall at one time or another in the last 10 years, and it's just sickening. They're like little children playing, all of them, and we're all being screwed by it.
Gary, thanks for the call. Roy, can you talk about the costs of a shutdown? Do we end up wasting money by virtue of the shutdown itself?
Yes. In fact, we waste a lot of money preparing for shutdowns, even if they don't occur. This is not the only time that a shutdown has been threatened and actually occurred, but there are many other times when a shutdown has been threatened and hasn't occurred. And what happens in the agencies is that they have to spend a lot of time preparing for shutdowns, and then when, in fact, if they do shut down, they have to start up their operations again. So I certainly agree with the caller. There's a lot of waste involved in this. Really, when you think about it, it doesn't make much sense to tell a federal worker who is providing a useful service to the country to stop doing so and then pay that worker anyway.
Talking to Roy Myers about shutdowns, past and present, the politics and history. We'll go next to Dominic in Oconomowoc. Dominic, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Hi. So I guess it's kind of a rebuttal to the caller from Sun Prairie, I believe, from where he talked about the Republicans and kind of how they've kind of been unfairly portrayed in this. And I guess I'm kind of a little disappointed because we're seeing the House Democrats bringing about other budgets and versions to the floor and sending it over to the Senate. But now Mitch McConnell is not really having a vote on the floor. And I guess I'm very disappointed. And we have to look back and see that this is $5.7 billion. It's not some chunk change like some people are trying to make it out to be, and that we need to refocus and see what exactly, how much or the bare minimum that we would need to bring compromise.
Gotcha. Dominic, Roy, do you see, and if you don't have a perfect solution right now, nobody will blame you, but do you see a path out of this current shutdown?
Well, I think eventually it'll come down to members of Congress and the president learning that they are violating an important norm in American politics, which is that it's good that we have full-blooded debates about our differences, but at the end we need to compromise and reach agreements to address the important problems in our country. And, you know, there are times when Congress and the president actually do that. And you know, take an issue that's important to Wisconsin and, for that matter, to Maryland, where I live, which is agriculture. They passed a farm bill recently, and it includes a lot of important things in it. But one of the problems with this shutdown is it's preventing what was adopted in the farm bill from actually being implemented by the Department of Agriculture. So if you're somebody who's basically wants to go out and buy seed next for the next planting season, that's not possible now if you need an operating loan from the federal government to do that. So eventually there'll be enough, for example, farmers telling their senators, whether they're Democratic or Republican, that it's time to end this shutdown and allow the Department of Agriculture and the other agencies that aren't allowed to operate to do so. Now, what I hope is that members of Congress will take that criticism that they've received, and for that matter, President Trump, who I think deserves much more criticism, and will learn from it and not do this again.
We'll leave it there for now. Roy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Roy Myers, professor of political science and affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He joined us today to talk about how government shutdowns have evolved in American politics and some thoughts on possible fixes for the risk of government shutdowns.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, a lot of people in their 50s and up want or need a job, but our guest says they're having a hard time finding one, even in the midst of an economic recovery.
Many policymakers and others ask and write and talk about how we can save rural America. Our guest says, hold on, we need to think of another way of framing this and start paying attention to the ways rural communities are actually saving themselves.
And we'll round up some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science.
That, and we'll take a look at some of the top news stories of the day, including likely an update on what's going on with the government shutdown we've just been talking about and the possible impacts on us here in Wisconsin. And of course, you can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page on that and other issues. And you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's what to look for coming up Monday here on Central Time.